"With you, Anna?" he asked, when they'd gone a few hundred yards.
"It's a bad omen," she replied.
"What nonsense," said Oblonsky. "You're here, and that is the chief thing. You can't think how my hopes rest on you."
"And have you known Vronsky long?" she asked.
"Yes. Do you know we hope he will marry Kitty?"
"Yes," said Anna softly.
"But let us talk about your affairs," she added, shaking her head, as if she wished physically to drive away something superfluous that hampered her.
"Let us talk of your affairs. I've received your letter and have come."
"Yes, all my hopes are fixed on you," said her brother.
"Well, tell me all about it."
And Oblonsky began his story. On reaching his house, he helped his sister out of the carriage, pressed her hand, and drove off to his office. Chapter 19. When Anna arrived, Dolly was sitting in her little drawing-room, giving a fair-haired, plump little boy, who already resembled his father, a French reading lesson. The boy, as he read, kept twisting and trying to pull off a loose button that hung from his jacket. His mother moved his plump little hand away several times, but it always returned to the button. At last, she pulled the button off and put it into her pocket.
"Keep your hands quiet, Grisha," she said,
and again took up the rug she was knitting, a piece of work begun long ago to which she always returned in times of trouble, and which she was now knitting, nervously throwing the stitches over with her fingers and counting them. Though she had sent word to her husband the day before that she did not care whether his sister came or not, she had prepared everything for her visit and awaited her with agitation. Dolly was overpowered by her sorrow, and was quite absorbed by it. Nevertheless, she remembered that her sister-in-law, Anna, was the wife of one of the most important men in Petersburg, and a grande dame. Thanks to that circumstance, she did not carry out her threat to her husband, and did not forget that her sister-in-law was coming. "After all, it is not in the least Anna's fault," thought she. "I know nothing but good about her, and she has never shown me anything but kindness and friendship." It was true that, as far as she could remember her visit to the Karenins in Petersburg, she had not liked their house. There seemed to be something false in the tone of their family life. "But why should I not receive her? If only she does not try to console me," thought Dolly. "All these consolations and exhortations and Christian forgiveness, I have considered them 1,000 times, and they are all no good." All these last days Dolly had been alone with her children. She did not wish to talk about her sorrow, yet with that on her mind she could not talk about indifferent matters. She knew that one way or other she would tell Anna everything, and now it pleased her to think how she would say it, and then she felt vexed to have to speak of her humiliation to her, his sister, and to hear from her set phrases of exhortation and consolation. As it often happens, though she kept looking at the clock, waiting for Anna, she let the moment when her visitor arrived go by without even hearing the bell. And when she heard soft steps and the rustle of petticoats already in the doorway, she looked round with an expression not of pleasure but of surprise on her careworn face. She rose and embraced her sister-in-law. "So you're here already," she said, kissing her. "Dolly, I am so pleased to see you." "And I am pleased too," said Dolly, with a feeble smile, trying to guess from Anna's expression how much she knew. "She must know," she thought, noticing the look of sympathy on Anna's face. "Come, let me take you to your room," she went on, trying to put off as long as possible the moment for explanation.
"This is Grisha? Dear me, how he has grown," said Anna.
And having kissed him, she stood with her eyes fixed on Dolly and blushed. "No, please, do not let us go anywhere." She took off her shawl and her hat, and having caught it in her black and very curly hair, shook her head to disengage it. "And you are radiant with joy and health," said Dolly, almost enviously.
"I?"
"Yes," said Anna.
"Why, dear me, here is Tanya. You're just the same age as my little Seretsa," she added, turning to the little girl who had run into the room,
and, taking her in her arms, Anna kissed her.
"Sweet girlie, darling! Oh, let me see them all."
She not only mentioned them all by name, but remembered the years and even the months of their births, their characters, and what illnesses they had had, and Dolly could not help appreciating this.
"Shall we go and see them?" she said.
"It is a pity Vasya is asleep." Having looked at the children, they returned to the drawing-room, and, being now alone, sat down to coffee at the table. Anna took hold of the tray, but then pushed it aside.
"Dolly," she said,
"he has told me." Dolly looked coldly at Anna. She expected now to hear words of insincere sympathy, but Anna said nothing of the kind.
"Dolly, dear," she began, "I do not wish to take his part, or console you. That would be impossible, but, dearest, I'm simply sorry for you. Sorry from the bottom of my heart."
Her bright eyes under their thick lashes suddenly filled with tears. She moved closer to her sister-in-law and with her energetic little hand took hold of Dolly's. The latter did not draw back from her, but her face retained its rigid expression. She said,
"It is impossible to console me.
Everything is lost after what has happened. Everything destroyed." As soon as she had said it, her face softened. Anna lifted Dolly's dry, thin hand, kissed it, and said,
"But what is to be done, Dolly? What is to be done? What is the best way of acting in this dreadful position? That is what one has to consider."
"Everything is at an end, and that's all," said Dolly. "And the worst of it is, you understand, that I can't leave him. There are the children, and I'm bound. Yet I can't live with him. It is torture for me to see him."
"Dolly, my darling, he has spoken to me, but I want to hear it from you. Tell me everything."
Dolly looked at her inquiringly. Sincere sympathy and affection were visible in Anna's face.
"If you like," said Dolly, suddenly. "But I'll begin from the beginning. You know how I was married. With the education Mama gave me, I was not merely naive, but silly. I knew nothing. I know they say husbands tell their wives how they have lived, but Steva..." She corrected herself. "But Stepan Arkadyevich never told me anything. You'll hardly believe it, but up to now I thought I was the only woman he'd ever known. In this way I lived for 9 years. Only think that I not only did not suspect him of unfaithfulness, but thought it impossible. I then, just imagine, with such ideas, suddenly to find out all the horrors, all the abomination. Try to understand me, to be fully convinced of one's happiness, and suddenly," continued Dolly, suppressing her sobs, "to read a letter. His letter to his mistress, my children's governess? Oh, no, it is too horrible." She suddenly drew out her handkerchief and hid her face in it. "I could perhaps understand a momentary slip," she went on after a pause. "But deliberately, cunningly,
to deceive me. And with whom? To go on living with me as my husband and with her at the same time? It's awful. You cannot realize...
Oh, yes, I do. I do understand. Dolly, dear, I do understand, said Anna, pressing her hand.
And do you think he realizes the horror of my situation? Continued Dolly. Not at all. He is happy and contented.
Oh, no. Anna quickly interrupted. He is pitiable. He is overwhelmed with remorse.
Is he capable of remorse?
Interrupted Dolly, looking searchingly into her sister-in-law's face. Oh, yes. I know him. I could not look at him without pity. We both know him. He's kind-hearted, but he's proud, too, and now he is so humiliated. What moved me most is—and here Anna guessed what would touch Dolly most—that two things tormented him. He is ashamed of the children, and that loving you—
Yes, yes, loving you more than anything else in the world, she hurriedly went on, not listening to Dolly, who was about to reply.
He has hurt you,
hit you so hard.
He kept saying— No, no, she will not forgive me.
Dolly, gazing beyond her sister-in-law, listened thoughtfully.
Yes, I understand that his position is dreadful.
It is worse for the guilty than for the innocent one, she said. If he feels that the misfortune all comes from his fault.
But how can I forgive him? How can I be a wife to him after her? Life with him now will be a torture for me, just because I love my old love for him.
Sobs cut short her words. But as if intentionally, every time she softened, she again began to speak of the thing that irritated her.
You know, she's young, she's pretty, she said. You see, Anna, my youth and my good looks have been sacrificed. And to whom? For him and his children. I have served his purpose and lost all I had in the service. And, of course, a fresh, good-for-nothing creature now pleases him better.
They probably talked about me, or worse still, avoided the subject. Do you understand?
And hatred again burned in her eyes.
And after that he will tell me, am I to believe him? Never. No, it's all ended. All that served as a consolation, as a reward for my labours, my sufferings. Will you believe me? I have just been teaching Grisha. It used to be a pleasure, and now it is a torment. What is the good of my taking pains, of working so hard? What use of the children? It is terrible. My soul has so revolted that instead of love and tenderness for him, I have nothing but anger left. Yes, anger. I could kill him.
Dolly... Dearest, I understand, but don't torture yourself. You are so deeply hurt, so upset that you see many things in the wrong light.
Dolly was silent, and for a moment or two neither spoke.
What am I to do? Think it over, Anna. Help me. I have turned over in my mind everything I could think of and can find nothing.
Anna could not think of anything, but her heart responded to every word and every look of Dolly's.
All I can say is, began Anna, I'm his sister and I know his character, his capacity for forgetting everything. She made a gesture with her hand in front of her forehead. That capacity for letting himself be completely carried away, but on the other hand, for completely repenting. He can hardly believe now, or can hardly understand, how he could do it.
No, he understands and understood, Dolly interrupted.
And I?
You forget me. Does it make it easier for me?
Wait a bit. When he was speaking to me, I confess I did not quite realize the misery of your position. I saw only his side, and that the family was upset, and I was sorry for him.
But now, having spoken with you, I, as a woman, see something else. I see your suffering, and I cannot tell you how sorry I am for you, but, Dolly, dearest, I fully understand your sufferings, yet there is one thing I do not know. I do not know how much love there still is in your soul. You alone know that. Is there enough for forgiveness? If there is, then forgive him.
No,
Dolly began, but Anna stopped her and again kissed her hand. I know the world better than you do, she said. I know men like Steva and how they see these things. You think he spoke to her about you? That never happens. These men may be unfaithful, but their homes, their wives, are their holy places. They manage in some way to hold these women in contempt and don't let them interfere with the family. They seem to draw some kind of line between the family and those others. I do not understand it, but it is so.
Yes, but he kissed her.
Dolly, wait a bit. I have seen Steva when he was in love with you. I remember his coming to me and weeping. What poetry and high ideals you were bound up with in his mind. And I know the longer he lived with you, the higher you rose in his esteem. You know, we used to laugh at him because his every third word was, Dolly is a wonderful woman. You have been, and still are, his divinity. And this infatuation never reached his soul. But suppose the infatuation is repeated? It cannot be, as I understand. And you? Would you forgive? I do not know. I cannot judge. Yes, I can, said Anna, after a minute's consideration. Her mind had taken in and weighed the situation, and she added, Yes, I can. I can. Yes, I should forgive. I should not remain the same woman. No, but I should forgive, and forgive it as utterly as if it had never happened at all.
Well, of course, Dolly put in quickly, as if saying what she had often herself thought, or else it would not be forgiveness. If one is to forgive, it must be entire forgiveness. Well, now I will show you your room.
She rose, and on the way embraced Anna. My dear, how glad I am you came. I feel better now. Much better.
Chapter 20. The whole of that day Anna remained at home, that is, at the Oblonsky's house, and did not receive anybody, although several of her acquaintances who had heard of her arrival came to see her. She spent the earlier part of the day with Dolly and the children, and sent a note to her brother to be sure and come home to dinner. Come, she wrote, God is merciful. Oblonsky dined at home. The conversation was general, and his wife addressed him familiarly in the second person singular, which she had not done all these days. There was still the same estrangement in their manner to each other, but no longer any question of separating, and Oblonsky saw that explanation and reconciliation were possible. Immediately after dinner, Kitty came. She knew Anna, but only slightly, and came to her sister's not without fear of how she might be received by this Petersburg society woman whom everybody admired so much. But she noticed at once that Anna liked her. It was evident that her beauty and youth gave Anna pleasure, and before Kitty had time to regain her self-possession, she felt not only that she was under Anna's influence, but that she was in love with her, as young girls often are with married women older than themselves. Anna was not like a society woman or the mother of an 8-year-old son. The flexibility of her figure, her freshness,
and the natural animation of her face, appearing now in her smile, now in her eyes, would have made her look more like a girl of 20, had it not been for a serious and sometimes even sad expression in her eyes, which struck Kitty and attracted her. Kitty felt that Anna was perfectly unaffected and was not trying to conceal anything, but that she lived in another, higher world, full of complex, poetic interests beyond Kitty's reach. After dinner, when Dolly had gone to her own room, Anna got up quickly and went to her brother, who was just lighting a cigar. "Steva," she said to him, with a merry twinkle in her eye, and making the sign of the cross over him as she indicated the door with a look. "Go, and may God help you." He understood, threw down his cigar, and disappeared through the door. When Oblonsky had gone, she returned to the sofa where she had been sitting, surrounded by the children. Whether because they saw that Mama was fond of this aunt, or because they themselves felt her peculiar charm, first the two older children, and then the younger ones, as is often the way with children, had even before dinner begun clinging to her, and now would not leave her side. And they started something like a game, which consisted in trying to get as close to her as possible, to touch her, hold her little hand, kiss her, play with her ring, or at least touch the frills of her dress. "Now, how were we sitting before?" said Anna, resuming her seat. And Grisha again pushed his head under her arm, and leaning against her dress, beamed with pride and joy. "And when is the ball to be?" said Anna, turning to Kitty. "Next week, and it will be a delightful ball, one of those balls which are always jolly." "Are there any that are always jolly?" asked Anna, with tender irony. "It is strange, but there are. It's always jolly at the Bobrishovs and also at the Nikitins, while it's always dull at the Metzkovs. Haven't you noticed it?" "No, my dear, there are no more jolly balls for me," said Anna. And Kitty saw in her eyes that peculiar world which was not yet revealed to her. "There are some that are not as difficult and dull as the rest." "How can you be dull at a ball?" "Why cannot I be dull at a ball?" asked Anna. Kitty saw that Anna knew the answer that would follow. "Because you must always be the belle of the ball." Anna had a capacity for blushing. She blushed and answered, "In the first place, I never am. But even if I were, what use would it be to me?" "Will you go to that ball?" asked Kitty. "I suppose I shall have to. Here, take this," she said, turning to Tanya, who was drawing off a ring which fitted loosely on her aunt's small, tapering finger. "I shall be very glad if you go. I should so like to see you at a ball." "Well, then, if I have to go, I shall console myself with the reflection that it will give you pleasure." "Oh, Grisha, please, don't pull so hard. It's all in a tangle already," she said, arranging a loose lock of hair with which Grisha was playing. "I imagine you at that ball in lilac." "Why must it be lilac?" asked Anna, half laughing. "Now, children, run away, run away. Don't you hear? There's Miss Hull calling you to tea," she went on, disengaging herself from the children and dispatching them to the dining room. "But I know why you are asking me to go to that ball. You're expecting much from it and would like everybody to be there and have a share in it." "How do you know?" "Well, yes." "Oh, yes, it is good to be your age," Anna continued. "I remember and know that blue mist, like the mist on the Swiss mountains. That mist which envelops everything at that blissful time when childhood is just coming to an end and its immense, blissful circle turns into an ever-narrowing path. And you enter the defile gladly, yet with dread, though it seems bright and beautiful. Who has not passed through it?" Kitty smiled and remained silent. "How did she pass through it? How I should like to know her story," thought she, recollecting the unpoetic appearance of Anna's husband, Alexei Karenin.
I know something. Steva told me, and I congratulate you. I like him very much, Anna continued. I met Vronsky at the railway station.
Oh, was he there? Asked Kitty, blushing.
What did Steva tell you?
Steva let it all out to me, and I shall be very pleased. I travelled yesterday with Vronsky's mother, she continued, and she talked about him all the time. He's her favourite son. I know how partial mothers are, but
what did his mother tell you?
Oh, very much. And I know he is her favourite, but anyone can see he is full of chivalry. For instance, she told me that he wished to give all his property to his brother, that already, as a boy, he had done something extraordinary, saved a woman from drowning. In a word, he is a hero, said Anna, smiling, and remembering the 200 rubles he had given away at the station. But she did not mention the 200 rubles. For some reason, she did not like to think of them. She felt that there had been something in it relating personally to her that should not have been.
She particularly wished me to go and see her, continued Anna. I shall be glad to see the old lady again, and we'll go tomorrow.
Well, thank heaven Steva is stopping a long time with Dolly, she added, changing the subject, and she rose, dissatisfied with something, Kitty thought.
I was first! No, I! Cried the children, who, having finished their tea, rushed back to Aunt Anna. "All together!" said Anna, laughing and running to meet them, and putting her arms round them, she tumbled the whole heap of children, struggling and shrieking joyfully, onto the floor.
Chapter 21 Dolly came out of her room for the grown-up people's tea. Oblonsky did not appear. He'd probably left his wife's room by the other door.
"I'm afraid you'll be cold upstairs," remarked Dolly to Anna. "I want to move you down, and then we shall be nearer to one another."
"Oh, please don't trouble about me," said Anna, scrutinizing Dolly's face and trying to discover whether a reconciliation had taken place.
"It'll be too light for you downstairs," said her sister-in-law.
"I assure you that I sleep always and anywhere, like a dormouse."
"What are you talking about?"
asked Oblonsky, entering the room from his study and addressing his wife.
From his tone, both Kitty and Anna gathered that a reconciliation had taken place.
"I want to move Anna downstairs, only the curtains must be changed. I shall have to do it myself. No one else can do it," Dolly answered, addressing him.
"Goodness knows if they have quite made it up," thought Anna, on hearing her tone, which was cold and calm.
"Come now, Dolly, always making difficulties," said her husband. "If you like, I will do it all."
"Yes, they must have come together again," thought Anna.
"I know how you'll do it all," answered Dolly. "You will tell Matvey to do something that cannot be done, and will go away yourself, and he will muddle everything."
And as she spoke, her usual ironical smile wrinkled the corners of Dolly's mouth.
"Yes, a full reconciliation, quite complete, thank God," thought Anna.
And pleased to have been the means of bringing it about, she went up to Dolly and kissed her.
"Not at all. Why do you so despise Matvey and me?" said Oblonsky, turning to his wife with a slight smile.
All that evening Dolly maintained her usual, slightly bantering manner toward her husband, and Oblonsky was contented and cheerful, but not to the extent of seeming to forget his guilt after having obtained forgiveness. At 9:30, an unusually pleasant and happy family conversation round the Oblonsky's tea-table was disturbed by an apparently very ordinary occurrence which yet struck them all as strange. While they were talking about their mutual Petersburg acquaintances, Anna rose suddenly.
"I have her photo in my album," said she. "And I'll show you my Seretzas, too," she added with a mother's proud smile.
For toward 10:00, the time when she generally said good night to her son and often put him to bed herself before going to a ball, she felt sad at being so far from him, and whatever they talked about, her thoughts kept returning to her curly-headed Seretza. She longed to look at his portrait and to talk about him. Seizing the first opportunity, she rose
and, stepping firmly and lightly, went out to fetch her album. The flight of stairs to her room went up from a landing of the well-heated front staircase. As she was coming out of the drawing-room, there was a ring at the door. "Who can it be?" asked Dolly. "It is too early to fetch me, and late for anyone else," said Kitty.
"A paper's from the office for me, I expect," said Oblonsky.
A footman ran up to announce the new arrival, who stood at the foot of the stairs under a lamp. Anna looked down from the landing where she stood and at once recognized Vronsky, and a strange feeling of pleasure mixed with fear suddenly stirred in her heart. He stood in his overcoat, feeling for something in his pockets. When Anna was halfway up the top flight, he lifted his eyes and saw her, and a look of something like embarrassment and fear came into his face. She bowed slightly and went on. She heard Oblonsky's loud voice downstairs asking him to come in, and Vronsky's low, soft voice refusing. When Anna returned with her album, he had already gone, and Oblonsky was saying that Vronsky had called to inquire about a dinner they were giving next day to a celebrity who was visiting Moscow, but that he could not be induced to come in.
"He seemed so queer," added Oblonsky.
Kitty blushed. She thought that she alone understood why he had come to the house and why he would not come in. "He has been to our house," she thought, "and not finding me in, he guessed that I was here, and he would not come in because Anna is here, and he thought it too late." They all glanced at one another and said nothing, but began examining Anna's album. There was nothing extraordinary or strange in the fact that a man had called at 9:30 at a friend's house to ask about a dinner they were planning and that he would not come in, but it seemed strange to all of them. To Anna in particular it seemed strange and not right.
Chapter 22 The ball had only just begun when Kitty and her mother ascended the broad staircase, which was deluged with light, decorated with flowering plants, and occupied by powdered footmen in red liveries. From the ballroom, as from a beehive, came the regular sound of movement, and while they were arranging their hair and dresses before a mirror on the landing between the plants, they heard the accurate, measured sound of the orchestra violins just beginning the first waltz. A little old man who had smoothed the grey hair on his temples before another mirror and who smelt strongly of scent happened to jostle them on the stairs and stepped aside in evident admiration of Kitty, whom he did not know. A beardless youth, one of those whom the old Prince Shcherbatsky called puppies, with a very low-cut waistcoat, straightening his white tie as he went along, bowed to them and ran past but returned to ask Kitty for a quadrille. She had given the first quadrille to Vronsky and had to give the second to this youth. An officer, buttoning his glove, stood aside at the doorway to make room for them, and smoothing his moustache looked with evident pleasure at the rosy Kitty. Although Kitty's gown and coiffure and all her other adornments had given her much trouble and thought, she now entered the ballroom in her complicated dress of white net over a pink slip, as easily and simply as if these bows and laces and all the details of her toilet had not cost her or her people a moment's attention, as if she had been born in this net and lace and with that high coiffure and the rose and its two leaves on the top. When, just before entering the ballroom, her mother wished to put straight a twisted end of her sash, Kitty drew slightly back. She felt that everything on her must be naturally right and graceful, and that there was no need to adjust anything. It was one of Kitty's happy days. Her dress did not feel tight anywhere. The lace round her bodice did not slip, the bows did not crumple or come off, the pink shoes with their high-curved heels did not pinch, but seemed to make her feet lighter. The thick rolls of fair hair kept up as if they had grown naturally so on the little head. All three buttons on each of her long gloves, which fitted without changing the shape of her hand, fastened without coming off.
The black velvet ribbon of her locket clasped her neck with unusual softness. That ribbon was charming, and when Kitty had looked at her neck in the glass at home, she felt that that ribbon was eloquent. There might be some possible doubt about anything else, but that ribbon was charming. Kitty smiled here at the ball when she caught sight of it again in the mirror. Her bare shoulders and arms gave her a sensation as of cold marble, a feeling she liked very much. Her eyes shone, and she could not keep her rosy lips from smiling at the consciousness of her attractive appearance. Before she had reached the light-coloured crowd of women in tulle, ribbons and lace who were waiting for partners, Kitty never long formed one of the crowd, she was already asked for the waltz, and asked by the best dancer, the leader of the dancing hierarchy, the famous dirigeur and master of the ceremonies, a handsome, stately married man, Georges Korzunsky. He had just left the Countess Bonin, with whom he had danced the first round of the waltz, and looking round his domain, that is to say, a few couples who had begun to dance, he noticed Kitty just coming in. He approached her, that peculiar free-and-easy amble, natural only to masters of ceremonies, bowed, and, without even asking her consent, put his arm round her slim waist. She looked about for someone to hold her fan, and the mistress of the house took it from her with a smile. "How fine that you have come in good time," he said, with his arm round her waist. "It's wrong of people to come so late." Bending her left arm, she put her hand on his shoulder, and her little feet in their pink shoes began moving quickly, lightly, and rhythmically in time with the music, over the smooth parquet floor. "It is a rest to waltz with you," he said, as he took the first slow steps of the dance. "What lightness and precision! It's delightful," he remarked, saying to her what he said to almost all the dancing partners whom he really liked. She smiled at his praise, and over his shoulder continued to survey the ballroom. She was not a girl just come out, for whom all faces at a ball blend into one fairy-like vision. Nor was she a girl who had been dragged from ball to ball till all the faces were familiar to dullness. She was between those two extremes, and though elated, was able to control herself sufficiently to be observant. She saw that the elite of the company were grouped in the left-hand corner of the room. There was the beauty, leader, Korzunsky's wife, in an impossibly low dress, and the hostess, and there shone the bald head of Krivin, who was always where the elite were. Youths who had not the courage to approach gazed in that direction, and there Kitty's eyes found Stepan, and then the lovely head and beautiful figure of Anna in a black velvet dress. And he was there. Kitty had not seen him since the day she had refused Lievin. With her far-sighted eyes she recognized him at once, and even noticed that he was looking at her. "Shall we have another turn? You are not tired?" asked Korzunsky, who was a little out of breath. "No more turns, thank you. Where may I take you?"
"I believe Anna Arkadyevna Karenina is here. Take me to her."
"Wherever you please." And Korzunsky waltzed toward the left of the room, gradually diminishing his step and repeating, "Pardon, mesdames, pardon, pardon, mesdames," as he steered through that sea of lace, tulle, and ribbons, without touching as much as a feather, and then turned his partner so suddenly that her delicate ankles in the open-work stockings appeared as her train spread out like a fan and covered Krivin's knees. Korzunsky bowed, straightened his broad shirt-front, and offered Kitty his arm to conduct her to Anna. Kitty flushed, and, a little giddy, took her train off Krivin's knees and looked round for Anna. Anna was not in lilac, the colour Kitty was so sure she ought to have worn, but in a low-necked black velvet dress which exposed her full shoulder and bosom that seemed carved out of old ivory, and her rounded arms with the very small hands. Her dress was richly trimmed with Venetian lace. In her black hair, all her own, she wore a little garland of pansies, and in her girdle, among the lace, a bunch of the same flowers. Her coiffure was very unobtrusive. The only noticeable things about it were the wilful ringlets that always escaped at her temples and on the nape of her neck, and added to her beauty. Round her finely chiselled neck she wore a string of pearls. Kitty had been seeing Anna every day, and was in love with her, and had always imagined her in lilac, but seeing her in black she felt that she had never before realized her full charm. She now saw her in a new and quite unexpected light. She now realized that Anna could not have worn lilac, and that her charm lay precisely in the fact that her personality always stood out from her dress, that her dress was never conspicuous on her. And her black velvet with rich lace was not at all conspicuous, but served only as a frame. She alone was noticeable. Simple, natural, elegant, and at the same time merry and animated. She was standing among that group, very erect as usual, and was talking to the master of the house with her head slightly turned toward him, when Kitty approached. "No, I am not going to throw the first stone," she was saying in reply to some question, adding with a shrug of her shoulders, "although I cannot understand it." And at once she turned to Kitty with a tender, protecting smile. She surveyed Kitty's dress with a rapid, feminine glance, and with a movement of her head scarcely perceptible but understood by Kitty, she signified her approval of Kitty's dress and beauty.
"You even come into the room dancing," she said.
"She is one of my most faithful helpers," said Korsunsky, turning to Anna, whom he had not yet seen. "The princess helps to make a ball gay and beautiful. Anna Arkadyevna, shall we have a turn?" he added, stooping toward her.
"Oh, you know one another?" asked the host.
"Whom do we not know? My wife and I are like white wolves. Everyone knows us," answered Korsunsky. "Anna Arkadyevna, just one turn?"
"I don't dance if it is possible not to," she said.
"But tonight it is not possible," he rejoined. At that moment Vronsky approached.
"Well, if it is impossible not to dance tonight, let us dance," she said, taking no notice of Vronsky's bow and quickly putting her hand on Korsunsky's shoulder.
"Why is she displeased with him?" thought Kitty,
noticing that Anna had intentionally taken no notice of Vronsky's bow. He came up to Kitty, reminding her of the first quadrille, and regretting that he had not seen her for such a long time. Kitty, while gazing with admiration at Anna waltzing, listened to him, expecting him to ask her to waltz, but he did not do so, and she glanced at him with surprise. He blushed and hurriedly asked her to dance, but scarcely had he put his arm round her slim waist and taken one step when the music stopped. Kitty looked into his face, which was so near her own, and long after, for years after, that look so full of love which she then gave him, and which met with no response from him, cut her to the heart with tormenting shame.
"Pardon, pardon, a waltz, a waltz!" shouted Korsunsky from the other end of the room, and seizing the first girl within reach, he himself began dancing.
Chapter 23. Vronsky and Kitty waltzed several times round the room, and then Kitty went to her mother. But hardly had she exchanged a few words with the Countess Nordston before Vronsky returned to fetch her for the first quadrille. Nothing special was said during the quadrille. They talked in snatches about the Korsunskys, husband and wife, whom Vronsky very amusingly described as dear 40-year-old children, and about a proposed stage society. And only once did the conversation touch her to the quick, when he asked her about Lievin, whether he was still in Moscow, and added that he had liked him very much. But Kitty had not expected more from the quadrille. She waited with a clutch at her heart for the mazurka. It seemed to her that the mazurka would settle everything. That he did not ask her for the mazurka while they were dancing the quadrille did not disturb her. She was sure that she would dance the mazurka with him, as at previous balls, and she refused five other partners for that dance, saying that she was already engaged.
The whole ball, up to the last quadrille, was for Kitty an enchanted dream of gay flowers, sounds, and movements. She only stopped dancing when she felt too tired and had to be asked to be allowed a rest. But while dancing the last quadrille with one of the youthful bores whom it would not do to refuse, she happened to be vis-à-vis to Anna. She had not come across Anna since the beginning of the ball, and now she suddenly saw her again in a different and unexpected light. She noticed that Anna was elated with success, a feeling Kitty herself knew so well. She saw that Anna was intoxicated by the rapture she had produced. She knew the feeling and knew its symptoms and recognized them in Anna. She saw the quivering light flashing in her eyes, the smile of happiness and elation that involuntarily curled her lips, and the graceful precision, the exactitude and lightness of her movements.
"Who is the cause?" she asked herself. "All, or only one?"
And without trying to help her youthful partner, who was painfully struggling to carry on the conversation, the thread of which she had lost, as she mechanically obeyed the merry, loud, and authoritative orders of Kosunski, who commanded everyone to form now a grand rang, now a chaîne, she watched, and her heart sank more and more.
"No, it is not the admiration of the crowd that intoxicates her, but the rapture of one, and that one is... can it be he?"
Every time he spoke to Anna, the joyful light kindled in her eyes and a smile of pleasure curved her rosy lips. She seemed to make efforts to restrain these signs of joy, but they appeared on her face of their own accord.
"But what of him?"
Kitty looked at him and was filled with horror. What she saw so distinctly in the mirror of Anna's face, she saw in him. What had become of his usually quiet and firm manner and the carelessly calm expression of his face? Every time he turned toward Anna, he slightly bowed his head as if he wished to fall down before her, and in his eyes there was an expression of submission and fear.
"I do not wish to offend," his every look seemed to say. "I only wish to save myself, but I do not know how."
His face had an expression which she had never seen before. They talked about their mutual friends, carrying on a most unimportant conversation, but it seemed to Kitty that every word they said was deciding their and her fate. And, strange to say, though they were talking about Ivan Ivanich, who made himself so ridiculous with his French, and how Miss Eletskaya could have made a better match, yet these words were important for them, and they felt this as well as Kitty. A mist came over the ball and the whole world in Kitty's soul. Only the thorough training she had had enabled and obliged her to do what was expected of her, that is, to dance, to answer the questions put to her, to talk, and even to smile. But before the mazurka began, when the chairs were already being placed for it and several couples moved from the small to the large ballroom, Kitty was for a moment seized with despair. She had refused 5 men who had asked for the mazurka, and now she had no partner for it. She had not even a hope of being asked again, just because she had too much success in society for anyone to think that she was not already engaged for the dance. She must tell her mother that she was feeling ill and go home, but she had not the strength to do it. She felt herself quite broken-hearted. She went to the far end of a little drawing-room and sank into an easy chair. Her light skirt stood out like a cloud round her slight body. One thin, bare, girlish arm dropped listlessly and sank into the pink folds of her tunic. The other hand held a fan with which she rapidly fanned her flushed face. But although she seemed like a butterfly just settled on a blade of grass and ready at any moment to flutter and spread its rainbow wings, her heart was crushed with terrible despair.
"But perhaps I'm mistaken. Perhaps it was nothing of the kind."
And she again recalled all that she had witnessed.
"Kitty! What does this mean?" asked the Countess Nordston, coming up inaudibly over the carpet. "I don't understand it."
Kitty's nether lip
trembled, and she rose quickly.
"Kitty, are you not dancing the mazurka?"
"No, no,"
said Kitty in a voice tremulous with tears.
"He asked her for the mazurka in my presence," said the Countess, knowing that Kitty would understand whom she meant by him and her. "She asked, 'Are you not dancing with the Princess Shabatsky?' "Oh, it's all the same to me," replied Kitty.
No one but herself understood her situation, because no one knew that she had only a few days ago refused a man whom she perhaps loved, and refused him because she trusted another. The Countess Nordston, who was engaged to Korsunsky for the mazurka, told him to ask Kitty instead. Kitty danced in the first pair, and luckily for her she was not obliged to talk, because Korsunsky ran about all the time giving orders in his domain. Vronsky and Anna sat almost opposite to her, and she saw them with her far-sighted eyes. She saw them close by, too, when they met in the dance, and the more she saw of them, the surer she was that the blow had fallen. She saw that they felt as if they were alone in that crowded ballroom. On Vronsky's face, usually so firm and self-possessed, she noticed that expression of bewilderment and submission which had so surprised her, an expression like that of an intelligent dog when it feels guilty. Anna smiled, and the smile passed on to him. She became thoughtful, and he became serious. Some supernatural power attracted Kitty's eyes to Anna's face. She looked charming in her simple black dress, her full arms with the bracelets, her firm neck with the string of pearls round it, her curly hair now disarranged, every graceful movement of her small feet and hands, her handsome, animated face. Everything about her was enchanting, but there was something terrible and cruel in her charm. Kitty admired her even more than before, and suffered more and more. She felt herself crushed, and her face expressed it. When Vronsky happened to knock against her as they danced, he did not at once recognize her, so changed was she.
"A delightful ball," he remarked, in order to say something.
"Yes," she replied. In the middle of the mazurka, performing a complicated figure newly invented by Korsunsky, Anna stepped into the middle of the room and chose two men and two ladies, one of whom was Kitty, to join her. Kitty, as she moved toward Anna, gazed at her with fear. Anna half closed her eyes to look at Kitty, smiled, and pressed her hand, but noticing that Kitty only responded to her smile by a look of surprise and despair, she turned away from her and talked cheerfully with the other lady.
"Yes, there is something strange, satanic, and enchanting about her," thought Kitty.
Anna did not wish to stay to supper, but the master of the house tried to persuade her to do so.
"Come, Anna Arkadyevna," began Korsunsky, drawing her bare arm under his. "I have such a good idea for a cotillon. Un bijou!"
And he moved slowly on, trying to draw her with him. Their host smiled approvingly.
"No, I won't stay," answered Anna, smiling.
And despite her smile, Korsunsky and the host understood from the firm tone of her voice that she would not stay.
"No, as it is, I've danced more in Moscow at your one ball than I danced the whole winter in Petersburg," said Anna, looking round at Vronsky, who stood beside her. "I must rest before my journey."
"So you really are going tomorrow?" said Vronsky.
"Yes, I think so," Anna replied, as if surprised at the boldness of his question. But the uncontrollable radiance of her eyes and her smile burnt him as she spoke the words. Anna did not stay for supper, but went away.
Chapter 24. "Yes, there's certainly something objectionable and repellent about me," thought Levin after leaving the Shcherbatskys as he walked toward his brother's lodgings. "I do not get on with other people. Oh, they say it is pride. No, I'm not even proud. If I had any pride, I should not have put myself into such a position. And he pictured to himself Vronsky, happy, kind, clever, calm, and certainly never placing himself in such a terrible position as he, Lievin, had been in that evening. Yes, she was bound to choose him. It had to be so. And I have no cause to complain of anyone or anything. It was my own fault. What right had I to imagine that she would wish to unite her life with mine? Who and what am I? A man of no account, wanted by no one, and of no use to anyone. And he remembered his brother Nikolai, and kept his mind gladly on that memory. Is he not right that everything on earth is evil and horrid? And have we judged brother Nikolai fairly? Of course, from Prokofy's point of view, who saw him in a ragged coat and tipsy, he is a despicable fellow, but I know him from another side. I know his soul, and know that we resemble one another. And yet I, instead of looking him up, dined out and came here. Lievin went up to a lamppost and read his brother's address, which he had in his pocketbook, and then hired a sledge. On the long way to his brother's, he recalled all the events he knew of Nikolai's life. He recalled how, despite the ridicule of his fellow students, his brother had lived like a monk while at the university and for a year after, strictly observing all the religious rites, attending service, fasting, avoiding all pleasures, and especially women. And then how he suddenly broke loose, became intimate with the vilest people, and gave himself up to unbridled debauchery. He remembered how his brother had brought a boy from the country to educate, and in a fit of anger had so beaten the lad that proceedings were commenced against him for causing bodily harm. He remembered an affair with a sharper to whom his brother had lost money and whom he had first given a promissory note and then prosecuted on a charge of fraud. That was when his brother Sergei had paid the money for him. Then he remembered the night which Nikolai had spent in the police cells for disorderly conduct and the disgraceful proceedings he had instigated against his brother Sergei Ivanich, whom he accused of not having paid out to him his share of his mother's fortune. And lastly, the time when his brother took an official appointment in one of the western provinces and was there arrested for assaulting an elder. It was all very disgusting, but to Lievin it did not seem nearly so disgusting as it must have seemed to those who did not know Nikolai, nor his whole story, nor his heart. Lievin remembered that when Nikolai was passing through his pious stage of fasting, visiting monks, and going to church, when he was seeking in religion for help to curb his passionate nature, not only did no one encourage him, but everyone, and Lievin among them, made fun of him. He was teased and called Noah and monk, and then when he broke loose, no one helped him, but all turned away from him with horror and disgust. Lievin felt that his brother Nikolai, in his soul, in the innermost depths of his soul, despite the depravity of his life, was no worse than those who despised him. It was not his fault that he was born with his ungovernable temper and with a cramped mind. He always wished to do right. I will tell him everything. I will get him to tell me everything. I will show him that I love and therefore understand him, Lievin decided in his mind, as toward 11 o'clock he drove up to the hotel of which he had the address.
"Upstairs, numbers 12 and 13, said the hall porter in reply to Lievin's question.
"Is he in?"
"I expect so."
The door of number 12 was ajar, and from within, visible in the streak of light, issued dense fumes of inferior and weak tobacco. Lievin heard a stranger's voice, but knew at once that his brother was there, for he heard him coughing. As he entered the doorway, the stranger's voice was saying,
"It all depends on how intelligently and rationally the affair is conducted."
Konstantin Lievin glanced into the room, which was beyond a partition, and saw that the speaker was a young man with an enormous head of hair who wore a workman's coat, and that a young, pockmarked woman in a woollen dress without collar or cuffs was sitting on the sofa. He could not see his brother, and his heart sank painfully at the thought that Nikolai lived among such strange people. No one noticed him, and as he took off his galoshes he overheard what the man in the workman's coat was saying. He was talking about some commercial enterprise.
"Oh, let the privileged classes go to the devil,"
said his brother's voice, with